Welcome to Saving the Game. This is episode 9, Faith and Fantasy, recorded Thursday, November 8th, with your hosts, Grant, Peter, Brandon, and Dan. Welcome to Saving the Game. I'm Grant.
I'm Peter.
I'm Brandon.
And this is Dan from Fear the Boot.
Woohoo! All right.
We finally have our first guest on.
And we decided to start with a good one, so.
Yeah. Dan, you're from Fear the Boot. What is Fear the Boot? Introduce yourself here real quick.
Okay.
Like we haven't already introduced Fear the Boot enough.
Well, just in case anyone is not familiar with Fear the Boot, Fear the Boot is a role-playing podcast that was started back in May of 2006, and it's had some changes along the way, but nonetheless is still going strong. And I'm happy to be over here because Fear the Boot consists of people who have a pretty diverse set of political and religious views. And so one of the decisions we made from the start was to avoid internal conflict and also to avoid stressing people out, was that we would not deal with politics or religion in the context of that podcast. So it's nice to be on a podcast that not only allows me to express that, but lines up with my views. So I'm happy to be here.
And we're glad to have you. In fact, listeners, this podcast would not exist without Fear the Boot, or rather Fear the Boot's forums, because Grant, Brandon, and I would not know of each other's existence without them.
Yes.
Yep.
Well, I've gathered it's Saragon, Time Spike, and I'm going to have to say one of those icons I don't recognize.
He goes by Silver Seraph. He's not quite as prolific a poster as Grant and I are.
I'm a little hurt, but it's okay.
I really don't post very much anymore, unfortunately. I've fallen off the wagon.
You've gone into Daughterville, you mean.
It's the same thing, I think. So, before we get to our main topic here, I do want to remind people we have our charity drive officially going now for PEG partners. If you're not familiar with them, head over to savingthegamepodcast.org. We've got a page set up where you can read all about them, watch some videos from David Lamott, the PEG Partners founder. They're a great charity. They do a lot of good work for Guatemalan schools, and actually they just had a fairly significant earthquake down in Guatemala, so now more than ever, there's a lot of kids and schools that really need some support because they're going to have to rebuild some facilities down there. If you're looking for a charity to donate to this Christmas, we'd love it if you donate to them. Go ahead and do it through us. We're trying to raise $150, which is actually enough to supplement a teacher's income for an entire year down in Guatemala, which is nuts. So yeah, go over to savingthegamepodcast.org and check that out. The topic tonight is one that Dan wanted to bring up with us, fantasy and faith, and we've got a couple of scripture verses that seem suitable for it. Peter, you want to take the first one?
Sure. The first one is 1 Chronicles 29:17-18. I know also, my God, that you test the heart and have pleasure in uprightness. As for me, in the uprightness of my heart, I have willingly offered all these things, and now with joy I have seen your people, who are present here to offer willingly to you, O Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, our fathers. Keep this forever in the intent of the thoughts of the heart of your people, and fix their heart towards you.
All right. And our second verse, Dan, you want to take that?
Sure. This is 1 Corinthians 12, verses 4 through 11. And actually, this kind of ties into the whole thing on fantasy and faith. So I'll probably be coming back to this here in a little bit, but I'll go ahead and read it for now. Now, there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. And the varieties of service, but the same Lord. And the varieties of activities, but is the same God who empowers them all and everyone. To each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. To one is given through the Spirit the utterance of wisdom, and to another the utterance of knowledge according to the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healing by the one Spirit, to another the works of miracles, to another prophecy, to another the ability to distinguish between spirits, to another various kinds of tongues, to another the interpretation of tongues. All these are empowered by one and the same Spirit who apportions to each one individually as he wills.
Very good. So, fantasy and faith. Dan, this is a really big topic.
Oh,
why
yes.
Why do you want to talk about it?
All right, here's why I want to talk about it. There are two reasons that I want to talk about it. The first of which is the fact that fantasy and myth speak, I think, very, very profoundly to the human condition. And I know you guys have some quotes you want to cover that kind of talk about this. I brought one as well here. And what I'm about to read comes from a book by a guy named Jim Ware. This is a book called God of the Fairy Tale, Finding Truth in the Land of Make-Believe. I quote, "And what is art but the soul's reflection, however imperfect, of the light that gives it life and definition? This is supremely true of story art. In stories, the subconscious mind gives voices to some of its most deeply cherished longings. In myths and legends, men and women make desperate attempts to tell one another who they are, why they are here, where they are going, and what they are meant to do. The tree revealed within our stories has its roots deep within the human heart. That's why stories make particularly promising hunting grounds for spiritual treasure seekers. At least writer G.K. Chesterton thought so. And it was precisely the human connection between story art and the image of God and man that led him to this conclusion. He who has no sympathy with myths, said Chesterton, has no sympathy with men." And so reason number one is the fact that I think not only do stories and myth in general connect us to kind of the simple yet profound and prevailing truths of the human condition, but what fantasy does that other genres don't allow for quite as easily, and I won't say it's impossible, it's not quite as easy, is to chase those back to man's relationship with the divine. If you take something like Star Trek, you know, unless we're talking about something hideous like Star Trek V, the existence of a relationship to
the divine. We don't talk about Star Trek
V. No, we don't talk about Star Trek V.
It's like Highlander 2. It doesn't exist.
It's like that one uncle at every family reunion. And
oh, for a second there, I thought you said Star Wars, and I'm like, wait, 5 was one of the good ones.
No. Star Trek here, you know, it doesn't as a whole deal with man's relationship with the divine. Now, it does deal some other themes wonderfully, but it doesn't deal with that aspect of the human condition. So that's reason number one. Do you guys want to hold there, or do you want me to shoot ahead to the second reason, and we'll back up and get some detail?
Let's go ahead on to the second reason, yeah. And then we can get some detail.
The second reason is if you look at the prevailing titles within fantasy, you see almost without fail people that kind of step away from making controversial declarations about man and the divine. For example, if you look at D&D or Pathfinder, in the vast majority of settings, in fact, off the top of my head, I believe pretty much all of the really popular ones, you have a pantheon of gods. And this pantheon of gods might draw from real historical pantheons, but a lot of it's fictional, or they have taken real pantheons, but these aren't pantheons that have any noteworthy following here within the world today, and they kind of fictionalize them from there. Or you get something like World of Darkness or Dresden, where they kind of chicken out in a different direction and say, well, we'll accept real world religions, but they're effectively all true. What really matters is the person's power of faith in something. It almost doesn't even matter what that something is. And one of the things that I have found that is not tackled in fantasy, and this baffles me, and here's why it baffles me. If you think about where fantasy has its roots, what we're really looking at here is, of course, the diversity of myths and legends over human history. But the setting that is typically chosen when we play fantasy is the Middle Ages, or thereabouts, give or take an age, you know, but more or less it's the Middle Ages. Well, the Middle Ages were not dominated by polytheistic or pantheistic religions.
No.
Culture was dominated by a monotheistic religion. That's not to say there weren't people that had, you know, their little cults or were into some kind of, mystery religions or some of these other things that were going on, because obviously they were. But society as a whole, throughout Europe, throughout the Middle East, it was very deeply entrenched in a monotheistic religion that says there is but one God. And that God has a very specific identity. That God has a very specific name. You know, there's a tradition or a story that defines that God. And so I've always found it kind of fascinating and, dare I say, accommodating, if not outright cowardly, to tell fantasy stories and yet never be willing to tell them from the standpoint that reality is a monotheistic one, since that's what people in medieval Europe would have generally told you is the case.
Sure. Let's be honest, most of the fantasy that we're familiar with is at least derived from Tolkien. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings is a very Catholic setting. It's not allegorically Catholic, but there's Catholic thought throughout it. And yet, there's none of that really in, like you said, most popular fantasy games.
Yeah, in fact, I've been sitting here kind of racking my brain as you guys have been talking, and I can't think of one.
Well, probably because, as Dan was explaining, that all of these fantasy games tend to bring out polytheism and stuff like that. I would say that that's probably a design allowing for more player choice. Instead of just saying, you have to follow this god and blah, 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 it allows players and stuff to interact more with a whole bunch of different stories. And also, we're trying to open ourselves up for more people. And it, for the exact same reason that your show, Dan, Fear the Boot, didn't touch on which of the religions or political beliefs were true, none of these games want to alienate any group of customers because they don't want to say, well, this is true. They want to say, hey, everything is open to belief and what you want to make your character to do.
They are saying something is true, but what they are saying is true is what they at least presume to be, and in many cases is, an inoffensive construct because of the fact that it doesn't hit on anything that, once again, the average individual is going to have a true faith in. And I say this once again, recognizing that some of the gods that they use are drawn from mythology, and there are some people involved in neo-paganism or whatnot that do still follow those gods. And so I recognize that as being true, but this doesn't speak to the majority of people that you're going to encounter.
Yeah, whatever the majority is, they're going to avoid it.
Right. To your other point, though, about wanting to tell diversity of stories, that's why I picked this passage from 1 Corinthians, because that was the approach that I took when trying to run a monotheistic game. And let me pause here for a moment to emphasize that I am not prescribing a monotheistic fantasy game as the right way of playing fantasy. I have run a lot of fantasy that had fictional or non-fictional pantheons as the prevailing religious truth within that setting. I've run World of Darkness games where I kind of let people just go by faith as opposed to really trying to dictate which of the religious traditions was true. So I'm not per se saying that this is the way that fantasy has to be played, but I am saying that I think, contrary to popular belief, especially within the right group, and there was a point in my life where I was gaming predominantly with other Christians, this is a type of game that can be done. Mm-hmm. And specifically to your point about wanting to tell diversity of stories, this is why I picked that passage in 1 Corinthians 12, because the broader truth that Paul is getting at here is one about sort of the relationship of people in a body of faith, that each of them is given a different task, a different ability, a different set of skills, and they are told that one, they ought to regard each other's skills and tasks as equal and important, and two, that these skills and tasks ought to be used for the betterment of those around you. If you are blessed with emotional strength or financial wealth or whatever the case is, that it is your duty to use this for the kingdom of God, and it is the duty of those around you to not look down upon the role that you have been given. Now, take this out to a fictional setting. So what you can set up is something like, you have a monotheistic God. Okay, there is one God. There's, you know, the God of the Bible, El, Jehovah, Yahweh, whatever you want to call him. That God, however, has followers who follow a variety of traditions based upon the gifts that they have. And so this would
basically
be
saints.
Yes, precisely. Something like patron saints, or orders that, even if they don't have a patron saint, at least have a series of overriding ideals that they are dedicated to. And you could compare this somewhat to the knightly orders of the Middle Ages and the Gothic Age, or to some of the monastic orders that are all throughout, really, the history of Christendom. And so you come along and say, you know what, I feel called by God to heal. And in the case of a fantasy setting, that's not just sort of a personal motivation. I can actually cast Cure Light Wounds or whatever. And as a result, you begin to follow an order. Now, let's keep following it from there. humans being imperfect, why did Paul feel the need to write 1 Corinthians 12? Well, because even though the truth is there is one God and one Spirit that is giving the gift to all people, what do we as people love to do? We love to divide. We love to judge. And so you can now start to build kind of a politic between these various saint orders or monastic orders, where even though they all give glory to the same God, that doesn't mean they're all always getting along in a perfect fashion. Right. And there's a situation, and one order may say, no, we're pacifists, we must deal with this through healing and understanding. And another order is like, no, evil has gone too far, it must be destroyed.
One order that wants to spread God's word through teaching me an enlightenment, and the other that wants to spread it at the point of the sword, because they think that their way is way more effective, because those people with the books walk in and everyone's arguing with them. They walk in with their swords and everyone's agreeing. And is that kind of what you're getting at in what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. And in some cases, it may just be a difference of opinion or a difference of approach. But in other cases, you know, we go back to the old bumper sticker that says, you know, as a Christian, I'm not perfect, just forgiven. And that's absolutely true. And you create these Christian orders, and even if they are giving glory to the one true God, the real God, that doesn't mean that these are going to be perfect people. They are going to make sinful decisions and do sinful things, and at some point may cross a line so far that that has to be dealt with. And so I think you can still tell a very rich story that allows for diverse faith traditions, even though you are saying all the while, there is but one God.
I think that many of the reasons that game products have not pitched a monotheistic worldview is because, well, then it limits the market share. I'm not saying it's right, wrong, or indifferent. I'm saying it's business. And
I don't think it's always that cynical. I think some of it is probably just industry momentum. This is kind of the standard way to do it. You have to come up with a pantheon. It's a checkbox, almost. It's kind of like every car comes with a radio now.
Well, the many different gods also give ideas for what kind of character you want to build. Do I want to build the guy who worships death, or nature, or the sun, or magic, or knowledge?
And I think the other thing it does is that it gives the opportunity to have conflicts between followers of something really evil that also grants power in evil ways.
Well, and you still have that capacity within monotheism. Now you just basically say, look, there are people, you know, you have the magicians of Pharaoh, you have the witch of Endor, you have people right. who have very real power, but it's a very real demonic power. And so you still leave a whole lot of room for people to do evil things and gain very real power from it. It's just instead of an evil God who is equal to the good gods in some kind of Gnostic sort of way, now you have evil beings who grant power but are nonetheless ultimately subject to a single all-powerful God. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the followers stack out the same way. Look, bad people can kill good people just fine. It's happened all throughout history. Yeah. And so the fact that my God is more powerful than your demon does not mean that when push comes to shove, you suddenly don't have the ability to kill me.
Yeah, very true.
And it's certainly, I think, speaking from a Christian tradition, there does have to be somewhat of a suspension of disbelief or somewhat of a suspension of perfect biblical theology, because obviously the game gets a little bit slanted if you have the guy who's a priest of some good or neutral attribute of God, you know, some good or neutral attribute or some good or neutral tradition.
Right.
And he encounters someone who derives his power from a demon and basically rebukes him in the name of Christ, and suddenly the guy's powerless. Obviously, theologically sound, not good for a game. And so you kind of have to suspend that a little bit, you know, such that the bad guy can still throw his blade barrier. And I think they took that spell out. But the point is, you know, they can still throw their cause harm the same way you can cast, you know, cure wounds. I recognize there does have to be some suspension of perfect theology, but I think the overarching structure does still work.
And you don't necessarily have to throw that out if you give it as a class ability. Like, X times per day, you can cut off the power of a dark being.
Oh, sure.
And, like, if you throw 5 dark wizards at them, you're able to say, well, which one of these guys do I want to cut off from his god? bam, that guy's gone.
Yeah. In a World of Darkness game that we wrapped up fairly recently, I was playing a Catholic priest. He could kind of just do that sort of thing. We were dealing with these very powerful things, basically Armageddon. And so I had this character who could do these sorts of things, and even though the World of Darkness is one where everything's kind of on an equal footing, all the supernatural things are supposed to be equal, the GM was like, you're a Catholic priest, you win. And it worked very well, because this was sort of the end of the world. This was Ragnarok and Armageddon and everything sort of being swallowed up. So yes, I can cast out demons, but there's a lot of them and I'm busy.
and that's certainly one approach. I think another approach you can take is to keep that human element in play. Let's take a D&D Pathfinder sort of approach to this. Your priest comes off the shelf with the ability to either turn or to rebuke undead, and then eventually that turns into destroying or taking control of the undead based on your level. Okay, so let's say we expand this now to include demons, for example. But I could even take this a step further to someone that is an opposing priest. Now, as a good priest, I might be able to rebuke this person or to rebuke the powers that are behind them and thus to shut them down. And there might be some roles involved in that to basically see, you know, am I right in the faith or am I in the position of the disciples who tried to cast out the demon and failed to do so? And, you know, Christ had to say, yeah, you didn't have the right heart in doing it. You know, where is my heart at when I attempt to do that? But on the flip side, the evil priest could do the same thing to me because Satan has power over God. No. But because of the fact that I am a fallen and corruptible human, you know, why does Paul talk about putting on the full armor of God? Why does he talk about watching for Satan, who's like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour? Because Satan has power over God? No. But because of the fact that the forces of darkness do have some leverage with us. And so you could get something where a dark priest comes forward and through his demonic abilities, he starts reminding me of my sins. He starts tempting me through some kind of evil. There's all kinds of approaches he can take that basically interrupt my fellowship with God. And so for a moment there, he can exercise the same kind of power over me that I can over him. But instead of going at the source of the power, he's going after the expression of the power.
Yeah.
Exploiting the human foibles and human weaknesses that make us corruptible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Our upcoming game is getting more complicated with every sentence you speak, Dan.
Yeah.
We're planning at some point to kick off a Pathfinder game that's going to be monotheistic and explore some of the stuff that we talk about on our podcast here.
I really want to get that started soon.
Yeah, I'm just like, okay, well, when this episode drops, I'm just going to be sitting here with a pen taking down notes from everything that Dan said.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I'll keep complicating it for you then. If you flip back to the book of Daniel, you see there where Satan ties up the angel Gabriel until the angel Michael shows up. And so in the same way that we can expand turning and rebuking to include the person, you could also go past that to angels and demons. And I realize you've got to be careful how far you open the field because of the fact that you can make priest effectively the only workable class in the game. So you've got to still keep some kind of game balancer in there. And that is...
Oh, let's not kid ourselves. Wizards already are.
Well...
Right? It's like, I forget who said it on your show, but you said the GM is, of course, the arbiter of all game balance. In the cavern of locked doors and traps, the rogue is God.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Basically.
And so there does have to be some kind of limiter here where the plot is being expressed through many aspects of many people. You don't want the priest to become just the I win class because of the fact that they can just call down the holy fire of God and that's the end of the game. You know, and I think that's, you can look back to Tolkien. He did a great job with that. You have people who have powers and have abilities, but even Gandalf talked at length about the preordination of how events had to go and how the different attributes, the unexpected attributes of the halflings, you know, would allow them to ultimately conquer an evil that men and elves and wizards couldn't conquer. And I think it's incumbent upon the game master to keep that as a very real element of the game.
Yeah, and Tolkien brings in, I think, sort of by inference, another way to handle this, which is to say essentially that God wants us to learn to do these things ourselves and not be handheld the entire way by miracle.
Yeah, I mean, just because the hobbits were the deciding factor in Lord of the Rings doesn't mean the men, elves, and dwarves didn't fight.
Right. But more to the point, Gandalf didn't, you know, wave a magic wand and solve all of his problems. The Ainu did not come over the sea and eradicate the armies of Mordor.
Yeah, and you see the same thing in C.S. Lewis's books, where in the Chronicles of Narnia, there are some issues that ultimately Aslan himself has to deal with, but a lot of the story along the way, and in some cases the story all the way to the end, is ultimately being done by humans, and what they're going through is a process of learning and of growth. And at no point in those books, to the best of my recollection, do any of the children drawn there from Earth just open hands and call down a flame strike. You know, they have to deal with these things. And these are people who have faith. You know, Aslan is the Jesus allegory lion. They have faith. And that faith does empower them to do things. And at time, Aslan or some agent of good, you know, you, for example, in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you had that one wizard, you know, will come through and will do something miraculous on behalf of these people, which I suppose you could extrapolate in a certain way to the spells of a cleric. But this was not the way that every problem was solved. You know, and you're absolutely right that it was about the growth of the individual and relationship with God. And that requires both a reliance on God, but also an exploration of and a taming of the self.
Yeah. The Silver Chair is all about that.
Yes, absolutely.
That one was mostly Jill's story, going from someone who was really not terribly strong in her faith and not confident in what she could do. The theological term here is escaping me. She did not find her strength in God to start with, and then throughout the quest gets that strength, learns to find that strength.
Yeah, or you see someone like, Eustace, boy that was added in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And he comes in just as an absolute faithless, selfish monster. And yet throughout the story, you know, as he has that growth, is able to express things in a lot of ways. You know, I mean, heck, he spends part of the story as a dragon, not as much as he did in the movie, but, you know, in the book still, he did spend part of the book as a dragon. And this is not a character that I think in any way, shape or form, especially at that point in his life, I would describe as someone who's a cleric or paladin. This is somebody who, if I was to put in D&D terms, I'd probably put as a rogue. He still nonetheless has a very powerful and important role in the story. So I suppose kind of the short punchline here being that I think in the process of bringing God into the story, you have to keep in mind that God is going to work in many people in many ways, not just those that he has called into a specific ministry, which in a fantasy setting is probably going to be expressed in the priest or the paladin. And I think one does have to be careful not to give so much power to those two classes that their game abilities make them destructive to the narrative.
Or the other way you could play this is that, yes, the priest and or paladin are the most powerful classes in the game, but the DM has to allow you to take another level at level up. Just because you trained hard doesn't mean God is giving you this. It would be an example and a I'm failing at the words here. It would be a...
It'd be an exercise in patience and humility, I think.
Yes. See, the way I would almost see about doing it is, I know that there's this thing called gestalting. When I heard about it, I was like, wow, this is the worst thing in the world, because it's basically, hey, get two character classes, take all their benefits, and cram them together. And I'm like, that sounds like horribleness. But I suppose if you had someone who you have them pick classes, you take out paladin, you take out cleric, they can pick whatever class they want, fighter, barbarian, rogue, ranger, stuff like that, not maybe even restricted to non-magical, and then add in the chance that they can earn additional levels in cleric that are just kind of, you don't get any of the weapon stuff, but you'll get cleric spells.
Right.
Like, you've gained a new clerical spell level because you have more faith in God and God is granting you more power.
My only concern there is leaving it up to the GM to determine that.
True. but then again,
that gets wonky.
I will admit that it can get very wonky because you're relying on the GM for balance. But then again, if the GM is sparing in enough of those handouts, so it's not like, oh, this person becomes 20th level cleric, and this person's still only level 2. You know, it's...
Yeah, I think if you're going to do that, it would almost have to be... You risk cheapening it, I think. I think if the GM just kind of hands out levels of cleric every 2 or 3 levels as opposed to every 1. Because effectively, I think a lot of the time it's going to boil down to that in play. It's like, oh, I really haven't given him some more, you know, abilities for quite a while. I should let him have something. And
yeah, it's his
turn. That natural GM inclination to kind of try and keep players interested and engaged
and
may win out over.
Be balanced.
Yeah.
See, that's where I guess I'm differing. And if I was going to do this and I was going to try to illustrate the rewards of actual faith in gameplay, I would say some people aren't balanced. This yeah. person has demonstrated greater faith, has done greater things. The problem there is it gets more into faith by works rather than faith by belief, which is not something I personally agree with. But it would be a very, I think, organic system for, well, this person has gone out and he's constantly given his money to the poor. Whenever it comes a deed to help someone, he does it. I've thrown him, like, thousands of temptations and he's never taken them. I'm going to give him a level. This guy is doing absolutely everything that... He's the rogue. He's stealing from other party members. He's doing all sorts of things. He's not getting this extra free level that this other person has.
Well, and with enough player buy-in up front, I think it's okay. And, it would be interesting... Maybe this is just me being contrarian. I would be really interested in being the guy who is surrounded by friends who are good people who have miraculous powers. Why does he not? What is he doing wrong?
Oh,
that would interest me. What temptation is holding him back? Mm-hmm. It'd be something to explore. I don't know that I could do it for a long game, but it would be an interesting thing to throw out there as a character.
And to throw another angle in, what about 1 Corinthians 13:1? If I speak with the tongues of men and angels but have not love, I am only a clanging cymbal. Because what we've been describing so far is just binding it to somebody's moral uprightness, which means that you could make a really good Pharisee character who would, you know, have all of this temporal power but doesn't actually have much in the way of actual faith.
Well, and I would also look at, let me give you two other examples to consider. The first of which is from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26, which is, "For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God." And let's go back to, like, Tolkien. Who had more faith in that story that things would turn out right? Gandalf or, not Bilbo,
Sam?
Frodo?
Frodo, I'm sorry. I couldn't think of the other hobbit's name for some reason. Who had more faith throughout the whole thing that it was going to turn out right? Gandalf or Frodo? And the obvious answer is Gandalf. I mean, Frodo throughout the whole thing felt pretty lost and frightened. And yet it was Frodo who carried that ring through. If we go to another scriptural thing, if you go to 2 Kings 9, you have a name that is synonymous with evil, Jezebel. You have a woman who is corrupt, who is involved in witchcraft. I mean, she is just through and through, I mean, one of the worst figures in terms of human figures that is ever brought out in scripture. Jezebel spends a lot of her life dueling with Elisha, who is one of the great prophets who had worked all these miracles and did all this stuff. And yet Elisha had to flee her. Who was it that killed Jezebel? It was 3 eunuchs who were told to throw her down by Jehu, who was just a regular guy. Jehu was not some prophet of Elisha's power. This was not a man who had done all kinds of miraculous works. This was not a man who had studied under the other great prophet of Elijah. You know, this was just a regular guy who kind of rose up, went and confronted him, and it was these 2 or 3 palace eunuchs that threw Jezebel to her death at Yehu's request. That's where that story ends. And so I think you still have a very strong place for these other characters, provided, once again, the game is not so imbalanced in the reimagining or the reinterpreting of the priestly class as to make it to the point that Yehu never has his opportunity because the Elisha character walks in and blows up the entire palace with a great big hand of God fireball.
Oh, yeah.
And I think also something you have to determine here is, what is the type of story you are trying to tell? Are you trying to tell a story that is fundamentally, for lack of a better phrase, message driven? That what you are trying to say is, this is a story about how faith is rewarded while faithlessness ultimately leads to chaos and destruction. And if this is really kind of a teaching story or a message story, then you might put a special emphasis on what the priest can do. For example, as it was suggested, giving out priest-type abilities as rewards based on the character of the person, or pulling them back as that character decays. But if what you're trying to do is more tell a story that simply has God as a strongly implied character, then I believe you can leave the classes of D&D pretty much intact. All you change is the trappings and the narrative of why a priest works. You change how that priest behaves. You change the kinds of things they say. You change what sorts of things they're rewarded for or punished for. But ultimately, you leave the class, in terms of its progression and power and balance, otherwise completely untouched. And that keeps the game balance, which we can nitpick to death, of the various editions of D&D and Pathfinder still, at least in their status quo. I mean, maybe not balanced, but at least in their status quo. Yeah.
Their default level of imbalance.
Yes, exactly.
And that is exactly what I was trying to hit at, Dan. I should have you here all the time so that when I go off on these things, you can say my words all pretty, like, so people can understand. This is not something that I would say that all games, every game should be, where a cleric is taken out and just handed it randomly, but it would be a very specific game with a specific purpose to say a very specific message. I love playing a cleric, and if I was playing a cleric in a normal, regular game where the cleric was pseudo-imbalanced with everything else, or not really pumped up to this level of one true god power, and then I would be pretty angry when the DM started going, oh no, I'm taking away your level in cleric. You're now only a fourth level character and everyone else is level 6.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been like, what?
God ways are not our ways and his thoughts are not our thoughts. I mean, look, yeah. Elisha, like I said, had to, or maybe it was Elijah, wanted to, had to flee Jezebel. Could God, through that prophet, have struck down fire from heaven? Sure, this was not out of the realm of what these prophets were recorded doing, but it didn't happen. You know, it was through a regular guy that God chose to work. And in the same way, you can say, yeah, God could theoretically take your cleric and take him from a zero-level acolyte and in one moment take him all the way up to a 20th-level cleric just because God so chose. But that's not necessarily how God's going to choose to have that story play out. Once again, we go back to, there are many gifts, there are many capacities, but they all come from the same God. Yehu was a man who was not a prophet, at least in the sense of a wonder-working prophet. He was just a regular guy. And yet it was through him, it was through his gifts that God chose to work that act. It was not through the acts of the very powerful prophets that were his contemporaries.
And I think the story that you're telling also says a very important thing about balance is, why was the more powerful prophet being the one who was targeted? Because he's the more powerful prophet. If the forces of evil are going to go after someone, they want to go after the big guy who has all the power. So yeah, maybe you giving these, you know, in my theoretical game, maybe you giving me the guy who is now 10 levels of cleric and is way more powerful than everyone, but he's drawing other evil things that can sense how powerful he is and want to take him down with a vengeance because they're afraid of him. And like, oh, you are just a regular rogue who has nothing. Whatever. In fact, I'll try to tempt you and work with you. I really don't care, but this guy has to go down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of becomes a supernatural version of the fastest gun in the West. Everybody's trying to prove that they were the one who shot him.
to back up just a little bit, what we were saying earlier about fantasy not necessarily requiring this focus on Christian themes if you're playing a Christian fantasy game. there are a lot of pieces of fantasy literature that take that tack. I'm thinking in particular of The King of Elfland's Daughter. It's basically an English fairy tale, but in an explicitly Christian world. The fact that fairy exists, you know, this realm of fairy and these powerful mythological creatures exist, does not negate the fact that God also exists and that God's church has power. It's a truth, but it's not the story being explored. And that's just one example that pops into my head. There's dozens, if not hundreds, of other pieces of fantasy literature that take that same perspective, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah, Ted Decker's Circle series comes to mind. It's not a terribly well-known series. The first book in the series was given to me as a gift by my mom. And actually, I was like, eh, really? And I started reading it. I was like, wow, it's actually a pretty good book. But it's the same sort of thing. It's a fantasy story where God is, in some cases, an explicit reality, but more often than not, is an implicit reality. It's just kind of a prevailing theme or an allegory or whatnot to the story. It's not about prophets running around casting out demons. That's not how the story functions.
Discussing this got me thinking about both Dresden and Supernatural, which are involved in the game that I'm running, which is basically a Supernatural-esque game set in the Dresden universe. God appears in both of them, capital G God. And I know Dan was saying how the Dresden Files kind of diluted a bit, saying that all faith is what has power, but capital G God exists. Dresden talks to angels, or at least one angel, a couple times. And there are well-known characters who serve capital G God. In Supernatural, capital G God exists. The angels are at war with each other, and they're fighting, and that becomes substantially the plot in later seasons. There's a character in there who is God. Even those are, it's not about God, it's about these guys going out and hunting monsters and making the world a better place. But he exists. He exerts some kind of power over both worlds, and it could be said that he's aiding both people in both worlds.
Yeah, and I don't have a theological problem with that per se. In fact, one of the ways that I try to reconcile the existence of a monotheistic God in some of the fantasy settings I've run is to say that, well, maybe in this creation, God interacts with creation in a slightly different way. He's got a different plan for this creation. And so, for example, beneath God, there might be these kind of lesser powers that are themselves not God or worthy of worship, but they can sort of represent attributes and pass along power, and people can kind of interact with them on a certain level. I kind of got this actually from reading a little bit into what Forgotten Realms was saying at the time, which was they were
about Ao?
Yeah, about Ao, and where apparently the gods have a god. And it was implied, at least to the way I read it, that Ao was another circle. He was part of his own sort of pantheon, if we want to call it that, above which there might be another power. And so I kind of took this and thought, well, what if this all tracks back, not to a monist reality as in Hinduism, but rather to a monotheistic reality that ultimately there is one God from which these beings all in turn derive their power and then kind of pass a piece of that on, you know, down the line till eventually it ends up in the hands of a human priesthood.
Kind of theology as a military hierarchy kind of thing.
Something like that. But yeah, that basically it's a series of derived authorities, and man has more of an indirect relationship with the capital G God than a direct relationship. And is that theologically sound? No. But once again, it's within the context of this fictional world. We just say, okay, you know, in this fictional world, maybe God chose to approach things from a slightly different way.
Sure. And C.S. Lewis actually took a similar tack with his science fiction series. The people on Perelandra and I can't ever pronounce it
Malachandra?
Properly. Malachandra. Basically, Mars and Venus have a different relationship to God. They worship God in a way appropriate to them, because they're a different type of people. It's still God. It's still Christ. But they're different people. They have different weaknesses and different strengths, and so their understanding is appropriate to them as opposed to us. There's some validity to that, I think. Maybe more than you're giving it, Dan. I don't know.
The reason I'm hedging a little bit is because of this thought. One of the issues that I see in dealing with religion and gaming, or quite frankly, religion and any interaction of culture, is the fact that the word God has almost been emptied of its meaning. If you ask the majority of people, do you believe in God? According to every survey I've seen from America, or quite frankly, all across the globe, the vast majority of people, by an overwhelming margin, will say yes, they believe in God. But now if you start asking them, who is that God? What is that God like? What does that God expect of you? Well, now all of a sudden, things start going all over the board. If you want to use this as a measure, the Pew Center did a worldview study and just tried to find out how many people within America subscribe to the basic tenets of a Christian worldview. And they didn't get real nitpicky, or, you know, they didn't start getting into Calvinism and Arminianism and Thomism and all, you know, they kept it real high level. And what they found was, and I don't remember the exact number, but it was only somewhere between a quarter and a third of Americans actually followed the even the most basic tenets of a biblical worldview. And so when someone like Jim Butcher comes along and says, well, my world has God, well, I don't know Jim Butcher's faith. Okay, so I don't say this is a judgment of Jim Butcher. But when I see that in general in fantasy, whether it's medieval fantasy or urban fantasy or whatever, my follow-up question is, who is that God? You're just using the word, but who is that God? This is one of the reasons why I will always define it specifically as the God of the Bible, or God as in God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit, because now all of a sudden I am now identifying that God. I am not just using this kind of fuzzy feel-good word of, yeah, there's somebody out there somewhere that kind of likes us all. I am now giving this God a specific series of attributes, desires and designs and drives. And, you know, this is a God who has opinions on moral issues that may not line up with yours.
A history of interacting with humanity, too.
Right, yeah. God the Father instead of God the Grandfather.
Exactly. God the doting grandpa. So, or yes, absolutely.
God the vending machine.
Dan, when you said that you thought that the word God had been taken and sort of diluted, for lack of a better word, and I don't remember the exact
devoided word you said, was the exact word I used.
What?
Devoided. It's been emptied of meaning.
Emptied meaning. Like, I actually had a different thought play through my head. I'm a fan of Order of the Stick.
Uh-huh.
I recently played the Order of the Stick game, which I absolutely love, even though it's long and complex. And I played Ellen the Bard, because I love bards. In that game, one of his little sticks, and it's something that has in the show, is he created his own god called Banjo, the God of Puppetry. And I think that's, you know, it's absolutely a great example of, like, what I thought about the delusion of gods. By making so many of them, by weakening their power and making them all equal to each other and fighting, it does kind of delude the whole idea that there's one being that goes, boom, I have the stick, I can, you know, use it if I want to. When Ellen can pull out his little god on his hand and ask people if they believe in him, and if he does, the god gets more powerful.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, I think in many ways that same idea that there's this multitude of gods and they all grant power and squabble amongst themselves, it dilutes the impact that those have. One of the reasons I really don't like Forgotten Realms very much is,
oh, there's another god. Well, I just met the other one around the corner.
How many dozens of gods, and they're all kind of whiny.
Well, and on top of that, they also come and go very quickly.
They do, and that's, you know, that's a complicating factor, but they're not interesting, and they're not terribly meaningful.
Well, and then you've also got the additional problem of that most gods in fantasy are pretty much defined in the way willingness and frequency with which they smite followers of other gods. There's no, like, transformation of their followers' character talked about, really.
Right.
There's nothing like the forgiveness of sins or, you know,
it's a very bottom-up religion. You wake up one day and you say, hey, I'm into traveling. Therefore, I'm going to give homage to the god of travel. And as a result, for example, in the case of the Forgotten Realms, the power of a god comes from the devotion of his or her followers. And so that god gains their godliness and sustains their godliness because of the fact that I woke up one morning and decided I like traveling. And it's a very bottom-up religion.
Well, in the Forgotten Realms, it's not just the god of traveling. It's the god of traveling west by a boat painted purple.
Well, yeah, fair enough. Let me say that for that very reason, I cut off my updating of the setting. I use newer rules, but I still play with a much older setting because I did not like where the Forgotten Realms went really throughout and there and following the Time of Troubles because of the fact that I think it just went into that absolute chaos. But that's just personal taste in fiction. But you have a very different kind of God because of the fact that, like you just said, it is not a God who comes to you and desires a relationship that you did not earn, desires to transform you in ways that you may not desire, and is doing so for a betterment that you may not see. It's quite the reverse. You decide what it is you believe. You decide what it is you want. And then basically you just shop until you find the God that will give it to you. And then that God in turn kind of has to, because, and I realize this is going to vary from fantasy setting to fantasy setting, but at least in the case of this particular fantasy setting, that God gains their powers from your devotion. And so ultimately that God is just as beholden to you as you are beholden to him or her, which creates a very different image of God. Now, I think you can tell compelling stories within that framework, and I don't object to playing fantasy games that have fictitious gods. You know, I would not even have a problem playing in a game with someone who was of a different real world faith. If someone came to me and said, I am a Buddhist and I want to run a Buddhist game, I would not have a problem with that. If someone came to me and said, I'm a Muslim and I want to run a Muslim game, I would not have a problem with that. You know, I would treat it in a certain sort of way. As a Christian, I am going to posit that there is one truth, and I am going to approach these games in a different sort of way. But that doesn't mean, therefore, there is no value to those stories. There's no value to the exercise of playing those games. And I play a lot of games that have very non-Christian cosmologies.
If nothing else, you're going to learn something about somebody else's faith.
Yeah. And, you know, this actually brings up something else that has always bothered me about religions in fantasy games specifically. There is very little room for faith and trust in God in fantasy games. And Dan, I think there was a Fear the Boot episode a while back where you touched on
there
this.
There was at least one, maybe it was a two-parter where we talked about faith in games.
Yeah, it was specifically, you know, if you have a God who can show up at your breakfast table, who gives you explicit, obvious divine powers on a daily basis, unless you don't pray to him, in which case you don't get those this day, there's very little room for the Christian virtue of faith and, you know, that trust and hope that we have in God. The God at the breakfast table is not the Christian God that we have faith in, that we hope for salvation from. There's no room for trust in that almost. It's just,
there's no room for
faith. I showed up for work today.
Well, I think that
this is the men have faith, angels have certainty. Only men have certainty too now.
Right.
Let me kind of spin this from a somewhat different angle, which is to say that I certainly think you would take away the portion of theology that is based on, you know, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe or whatnot. There is a certain element or certain aspect of faith that gets eroded in that sort of environment. But I actually think in a way it brings forward the issue of faith in a different way. And here's what I mean. The word that is used for faith most frequently throughout the New Testament is the Greek word pistis. And what that Greek word means, I think I even mentioned this in the Fear of the Boot episode. And what that Greek word means is not a blind, fumbling hope. Because if you were going to take faith from that angle, then quite frankly, anything might be true. Because if you're just going to say, you know what, I'm just going to believe in this because I believe in it, you end up in circular logic, and quite frankly, everything is as plausible as the next. But what pistis instead describes is an abiding relationship. It described actually, in many cases, the political or military relationship between a client state and a patron state, between, for example, Rome and the rest of its empire, where the idea is that I may not know exactly what you are going to do. I may not know exactly where this is headed. I can't tell the future. But there is some history here based upon evidence that gives me a desire to abide in this relationship. Okay, so let's use a couple analogies here. I often describe Christianity as being something like a dropped wallet. Now, if I am out in public and I drop my wallet and a complete stranger picks it up and hands it to me, and I don't know how long it's been out of my possession, I may be polite not do it in front of him, but you better believe as soon as I'm around the next corner, I'm going to check and see if my money and credit cards are there. And quite frankly, you'd be an idiot not to. And, you know, I'm going to keep an eye on my bank statement to make sure he didn't, like, write down my credit card numbers or something like that while it's out of my possession. Now, a lot of people think that's the kind of faith that Christianity calls for, that we're just going to blindly believe in something. But that's not what the New Testament or even the Old Testament teaches. It teaches to believe in a God based on evidence, that God has interacted with history, has interacted with us, continues to interact with history. And based on that and a study of his word and all these other things, and to get into Christian apologetics would obviously require a whole new podcast unto itself. And I don't mean episode, I mean a podcast. Right. But the point being that based on that, we develop an abiding relationship with God. So now moving this to a fantasy setting, if I have God at the breakfast table, to use the phrase that was thrown out a minute ago, and I pray to him and he gives me certain powers for the day, you are correct that the sense of perseverance in the absence of the material signs we may want has now been eradicated. And so therefore, a certain element of faith, a certain aspect of faith is no longer really necessary. You know, I don't know how you can possibly play an atheist in the average fantasy setting. You have got to be the most deluded, crazy guy to see people raising the dead and throwing fireballs and say, yeah, there's nothing else out there. But this other aspect, this pistis aspect of faith, this idea of an abiding, trusting relationship, I think very much can be brought back to the front, because the question gets raised, am I following God because I love God, because I have a relationship with God, because I've trusted in God, or am I following God for commercial reasons? It's pure commerce. I put in my prayers and my due diligence, and I act like a good boy, and in return, I get cure light wounds. And if you read throughout Scripture, that's not the kind of follower God desires. And so that is not the kind of faith that we are called to have. I agree that it does change the nature of faith, but I don't think it eliminates the question of faith, especially if you have deep and well-developed characters who have sufficient internal dialogue to really be dealing with those kinds of questions of, why is it I follow this God? Do I love this God? Do I even like this God? Or do I just like what I get from this God?
Sure. I think for all of this discussion, deep and interesting characters are almost a prerequisite.
I would almost go so far to say usually for a good game, deep and interesting characters are needed. Unless by good game you mean Dungeon Crawl hack and slash, which is not my definition.
Or a comedy game. Some of those sometimes are made better by shallow characters. But yes, yeah, I think for what we're talking about here, yeah, absolutely. I would agree.
But there are two points that I've had, and one of them was brought up when Dan said the whole idea of atheists in a fantasy setting, and I have a solution to that that comes from a TV show. But the other one that I wanted to say is, it goes back to what Grant said about religion and how he was going to draw on something that was said on Fear the Boot, and it reminded, and I thought he was going to go in a totally different way, back to the whole thing about the episode you guys did on myths and legends, and you said one of the main problems in fantasy games with having myths and legends is everything is true, and the same thing happens with religion.
Yeah.
In every religion, maybe not ones that are practiced by NPCs, but probably even those too, but definitely almost anyone that's practiced by a player character is true. Yeah. And, you know, exists. Whereas I know I played a character in a D&D game that was actually supposed to be set in post-apocalyptic America, where I was a cleric of the Wizard of Oz. Believed not only was the Wizard of Oz a real person, but he actually had magic. And he had power because he gave him a brain, and, you know, courage, and a heart. And only someone with magic could do that, because his holy book had pages ripped out of it.
Which is funny, because actually, if you read through the summary of that series of novels that movie was based on, he is one of the few myths. because you have Ozma of Oz and you have all the witches of Oz who really did have those powers.
Right.
You know, they really could do that. So he was the only one in there who was genuinely a myth. The Wizard of
Oz.
He's
a charlatan.
Yeah, he was the only one that was the myth. The rest of them were true. And it does create an interesting sort of thing because, yeah, and to give credit where credit was due, it was Chad who brought forward that point. But yeah, in a fantasy setting, if a farmer tells me there's a dragon over the hill, why would I disbelieve him?
Yeah, start stocking up on potions of fire resistance.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, make sure I got my spell prepared for the day. Deal with that dragon that I know is over that hill.
I was going to say, and it may turn out in the end that the Game Master is using that as a plot device, and maybe it really is just a Wizard of Oz. It's a guy who can make funny noises and blow smoke from a cave and is scaring everybody. But the point being, though, that I have no a priori. I have no out-of-the-gate reason to doubt this guy. If he says there's a dragon, that is fully plausible. And if I see a dragon, it is not going to shock me. It may scare me, but it's not going to shock me.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things I love about Unknown Armies, which I talk about all the time, and I apologize, every major section of the book has two or three pages full of rumors, and it tells you most of these are probably wrong. Because, you know, it's an urban fantasy game, you're trying to find out secrets, everything is hidden. And so there's all sorts of little truths, some of which are true, but most of which are red herrings. And the whole idea for the GM is to just have everybody chasing down every possible rumor of power, and most of them should be utter nonsense. But some of them, just as wacky as the others, are absolutely true. And it's one of the few games I've seen out there that has any semblance of an acknowledgement that a lot of the stuff we hear and a lot of our myths don't have any real relationship to reality. Or they're, you know, a story that's gotten told and retold so many times, you know, a telephone game that's lasted 1,200 years, that it has no bearing on the actual story that actually happened.
Yeah, World of Darkness seems to do that in some places, though it manifests it in a somewhat different way, in that you have the purely mundane who may know nothing at all or have nothing but rumors and legends and conspiracy theories to go on. And then within those that are in the know, you know, the awakened or whatever they broadly call them within World of Darkness, they then might know some of the reality, but even they then have their layers of politics and lies and confusion about how things have actually occurred. I'm actually possibly about to be starting as a player in a mage game. And the game master wants to set this shortly after this week of total chaos that occurs in 1999, and he pointed me to the wiki and I was able to read what actually happened. But then he also came back to me and said, but here's what your character would likely know. Some of it's true, some of it's half true, some of it's fiction.
That's a great way to start it off, and it's a hard thing to do. I have real trouble playing characters who know false things. It's just a weakness of mine as a player.
See, I love playing someone who believes something that is wrong, and I know he believes it's wrong, and I will push him forward to that wrong thing, and when he gets there and is disappointed, I will be happy. But that's just me.
And I wish I could do that, because that sounds like a fun character to play. I can't do it.
I'm with you. I'm the same way. I can play a character who's ignorant, but to play a character who is misled is a lot harder for me.
Yeah, I fall in with you guys on this one. It's ignorance is so much easier to model because you just don't know something. If you, the player, know something that your character doesn't, I'm pretty good at keeping player knowledge and character knowledge separate, but things like fundamental truths of the setting, that starts to get really hard to not at least start nudging the character towards knowing that in play, so I'm not carrying that burden anymore.
Well, see, for me, it's never something like, this is something that's going to get me killed. But I could very well believe that person X killed my parents. Or you know, killed my sister or something else, so I'm not Batman. But, in fact, it wasn't that person X. And there will be nothing person X will ever say, and I will know, as a person, this person is wrong, but it would take extreme effort for my character to accept that. And it was this exact same thing about my Tin Man character. I wanted the GM to put in a character who was going to pretend to be the Wizard of Oz and was going to take my character on a ride. And I was willing to accept whatever the GM was going to throw at me, as long as it didn't get too far off and my character didn't start doubting, is this guy the actual wizard and blah, blah, blah. But, like, and then go to a whole big thing.
You
but
had something
like,
genuinely disturbing. Did you know the Tin Man was originally human?
Yes. Yeah.
That's why he wanted what he wanted, was he wanted his heart back.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. The really creepy part is when he goes back and find all of his original human parts having been reassembled and
mixed with another
back
guy.
With his wife.
Mixed with another guy.
I've told that story to plenty of people. Again, thank you, Dan, for first enlightening me to the Tin Man.
You guys actually mentioned that in one of your Fear the Boot episodes.
We did. Because I was curious about the story of the Wizard of Oz, because I knew it came from a series of novels. Now, I did not realize at the time it was 14 novels, but I knew it came from a series of novels. And I started reading some of the plot synopses, and my jaw just kept getting lower and lower and lower as I was reading these things. And I'm like, the hell was wrong with this guy?
Yeah, I know. See, the thing is, the Wizard of Oz was ruined for me as soon as I started interpreting it as an argument for the gold standard. I'll try and find a link for this in the show notes, but we actually studied The Wizard of Oz as an allegorical argument for keeping the gold standard for U.S. currency.
No, it was for adding the silver standard, actually.
Was it the other way?
Yeah, it was okay. Because
I can't remember.
It's a story about a farming girl. A naive girl going along with the farmers and the industrial workers, and William Jennings Bryan, who was the Cowardly Lion, to the president, who had no real power, but, you know, was, you know, the one who's keeping everything together, and they were going down a road of gold with shoes of silver.
Yep.
And along the way, they had to deal with drugs, and, you know, other sorts of things that happened in, you know, the book that I don't quite remember, but it fits really well.
The whole thing is this remarkably potent and very detailed political argument. It's very funny. Anyway,
I did the whole
derailed
thing. I'll give you one last rail on that, and then we'll go back. Something I've always wanted to know is, where do the other roads lead? And it may be handled in the novels and not handled in the movie, but there's like a red brick road and a blue brick road. Where do those go? If the yellow brick road goes to
nowhere good,
I guess nowhere good. They go to different builds of magic decks. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say varieties of Pokemon games, but
yeah, this goes to the land of the white mana. This goes to the land of the blue mana.
Anyway, Dan, you had said something about atheists in fantasy settings and how you don't see anyone being able to play them. And I honestly can, because
I wouldn't go that far. Just clear, I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm just saying you have to have a really oddball character. But go on, explain. I'd love to hear
actually,
your spin. Go on. Go on.
I am a huge fan of Stargate SG-1.
Okay.
And throughout that entire thing, they were fighting things that were essentially false gods, and then they fought things that were basically actually gods. But throughout the whole thing, it was these people saying, these aren't gods, these are just really powerful beings. Which is a way that you could, in effect, play a character. Yes, Paylor exists. Is he a god? No. He's not a god, he's just very powerful.
Right, which would be an interesting way, too, to bring in a Christian character or something that's an allegory for Christianity in whatever setting you've got. Somebody who says, these things are powerful, but they're not the real truth behind the universe.
And maybe and that character doesn't even have to be a cleric of that that god.
Not at all.
I was going to say, I should probably clarify precisely what I meant by an atheistic character. Because I agree with you. That would be a very plausible and certainly well-founded character, because let's go back to Forgotten Realms. I mean, if your character knows anything about the history of the realms, it's kind of an open secret that some of these gods used to be people, and some people end up becoming gods, and in some cases gods get demoted out of their godhood. And so the concept that they are not entirely other, could very plausibly lead to you sort of devaluing the gods in your mind. I think I was more approaching it from the hardcore material atheist who says, when you pray, you're basically just thinking to yourself to an imagined sky fairy, you know, that there's nothing out there. It's that kind of atheist, you know, the really
the
strict
nihilistic atheist.
Yeah, the very strict material atheist who says basically nothing exists beyond a material universe, I think would be very, very hard to play. Because in our world, okay, I can understand how people come to that conclusion because of the fact that they have life experiences that lead them a certain way, or they don't receive the kind of evidences that they're comfortable with, or whatever, okay? And a huge side discussion there to get into that. But I understand how people end up at atheism. And I've had many discussions with atheists about how they got where they are. But if you put me in a world where somebody can cast cure light wounds and throw fireballs, for them to say there's nothing but a material world, I think requires nothing but sheer insanity. Now, you could certainly take the other tack to devaluing it, saying, look, these are just properties of the world we don't yet fully understand. These are just beings that have attained this through some method of pursuing these powers we don't fully understand. So I guess you could create a character who, quite frankly, is ahead of his time or wildly anachronistic.
Well, and I think that's really easy to do in a setting that's based on something like D&D, where magic is very quantifiable, yeah, predictable, and always acts the same way. You know, it's at that point you kind of run into the old Arthur C. Clarke quote about any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Any sufficiently advanced magic is indistinguishable from technology, too. Especially if that's what these people have always grown up with, it's not going to seem supernatural at all. It's just a different kind of natural.
Yeah, so what? You can heal wounds. The bard can do that. He sings, and it happens. It's so what? You pray to this guy, and then you get power. You're just doing rituals, just like everyone else. You're a different kind of caster. Your thing doesn't have to exist.
Yeah, I guess even within Forgotten Realms, if you look at kind of the big religious distress, it didn't come from the non-existence from gods. It came from the discovery of a new layer of gods. Yeah. And so some people are like, well, man, I'd rather just get at the real power and skip over these middlemen. And so therein comes their great, you know, religious controversy.
But I will give you this, Dan. If you have, as Grant said, God at the dining room table, and, you know, he's there, and he's throwing fireballs, and he's in the alehouse drinking, and he's preaching to his people, then yeah, it's kind of hard to say, you don't exist, just like if actual God, capital G, showed up on the planet, you know, all powerful, doing things, it would be pretty hard for people to say, oh no, he doesn't exist. There would still be people, but, you know, yeah.
We've trod over an awful lot of ground here. Is there anything else that we still want to cover? Dan, since you're the guest, is there anything left that you would like to address specifically?
The usefulness of story to reveal religious truth. But I think while we never address that directly, we've been addressing that indirectly for the past hour and a half. And so
I think we kind of dealt with
the subject.
Yeah.
Well, like, the only other comment that I would say is, like, on the whole thing about religious truth is God used stories to reveal religious truth.
Yeah, yeah.
When Jesus was asked a question, a lot of times he answered in a parable,
yes,
which is a story, which is made up and fake, but it told something about a religious truth. The story of the men with the Good Samaritan is a parable, but it says something.
Yeah, in fact, you know, those stories, here's what's fascinating. Those stories were so powerful that not only are they still used to convey religious truth to this day, not only have they become the basis for many of our common cliches, the prodigal son, you know, the Good Samaritan. They become these social archetypes, but on top of that, they have actually affected our language. The word talent, so if you say that I have a talent in art or whatever, that is the exact same word that Christ used in the story of the talents. When Christ said talent, if you go back to the Greek word is talent. That word has carried down and changed meaning from a unit of measure, which I think was around 75 pounds. So incidentally, the guy who only got one or two talents, he had between 75 and 150 pounds of precious metal. So even the guy that got screwed still had quite a bit going for him. But that word has now changed its meaning, and yet we're still using it. It's the same Greek word, talent, but now we use it to refer to what we're capable of instead of a unit of measure, and that comes straight from that parable.
True, and like it's something that's still being used today. I was remembering something, like I sometimes go on 4chan on TG, and I was seeing a reference to a story this is one guy told about how the pastor at his church used to hold a D&D group where he would run a game for the kids. And they were, you know, all clerics and paladins and followers of this church that was having them go out and kill monsters and do all these other things like that. And of course, being little kids, they just automatically went out and did it and didn't ask questions. Well, a couple game sessions down the way, the pastor revealed that the church they were working for had been corrupted by a demon, and they hadn't been doing good things after all. And his whole point of that story was, don't ever blindly follow anything, even religion.
Which is a powerful message, but somewhat
but
unexpected
maybe not
enough
for kids.
Yeah, I'd say, yeah. Hey, let's tell my Sunday school class. By the way, you guys are all following demons. I mean, that's...
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that just seems like one of the things we always complain about from GMs. Hey, guess what? I'm changing the rules. You know, I don't know.
Well, but, you know that
it's,
guy.
It's funny though.
You
I mean,
thought
you're
the
right.
Story was about that. Oh, how wrong you are.
Yeah, but yeah, I think you know, teaching kids. There's a thread I've been following closely on the Fear of the Boot forums lately. It's a guy who works as a therapist in a group home for kids who have been traumatized and abused and are really very far behind emotionally. And he's starting up a D&D game for them to help them work through issues and put into story form real-life lessons. You know, and I'm really interested to see what he's got going on and really hear about that experiment that he's doing. I mean, it's role-playing. You know, therapeutic role-playing is a technique that's been used for ages. He's just doing it with D&D, I think, 3.5.
The rule structure, yeah.
Yeah. You know, when it's working well. And he had some concerns about violence, which is, I think, why he had posted on the forums. But I think the general response was, this is awesome. Keep doing it. Tell us all about it. Which says a lot for the Fear of the Boot forums, by the way.
This was something that I wanted to touch on that I think maybe we can get into a little bit more. Is
yeah.
That one of the useful things about putting a mythic sheen on things, and I've heard this discussed on at least one other RPG podcast. It may have even been Fear the Boot. I listened to a couple of them. But by stripping some of the real-world trappings off of things, you can just deal with the underlying concepts in a way that makes more sense. Like, something like slavery, instead of having to deal with, like, actual human-on-human slavery that, you know, took place in Egypt or in, you know, pre-Civil
War America.
The Missouri
Compromise.
Yeah, you can actually, like, have player characters be captured and enslaved and see what that's like. And gain some perspective on stuff that hopefully the real people that are controlling these player characters will never have to deal with. But maybe should get some kind of a sense for what the moral implications of are.
Right, we're role-playing out a situation that we otherwise would not have the opportunity to be in or never suffer from otherwise. There's a quote I always bring up when we start talking about myth and fantasy. It's this C.S. Lewis quote from his review of The Lord of the Rings, where he says, "The value of myth is that it takes all of the things you know and restores to them the rich significance which has been hidden by the veil of familiarity." I quote that all the time, and I apologize if I sound like I'm repeating myself, listeners.
I think
listeners.
That comes up about once an episode. It's
I do
a
try.
Really good quote.
You know what? I say it's a damn good quote. It deserves to come up once an episode, so...
Fair enough. But what Lewis is kind of saying there is basically, when we're talking about some of these things, even very important things like the lessons we've learned from Christ and his teachings, we're told, you know, do these things. And they're very simple things, but we have all sorts of roadblocks. Mental associations we have with everything we do and all the, you know, the ways we hear things over and over. You know, I hear certain biblical lessons and I don't hear the message behind it. I remember that I really hated the guy in my Sunday school class who I was sitting next to at the time, because he was kind of a you know, I don't, and there's a block there. So, but when the same message is presented a different way, whether that be through fantasy or something else, a different parable, whatever it is, you hear it again and you hear the truth behind it. And so fantasy, and really all RPGs in general, but, you know, fantasy gives us a way to take those myths and take those values and say, hey, really listen to this, because this doesn't have the same associations that'll distract you.
It's like you said, strip away the familiarity. I know that the Bible says that I ought to love my wife as Christ loved the church, and that's a very easy teaching to follow until she starts annoying me. And, you know, it's the familiar makes me fall shy of the ideal. And you could very well structure a role-playing game where there is someone in there that I am supposed to love in that capacity. And it's not always easy to. But because of the fact that it's an unfamiliar story, I have to suddenly revisit what in my home life is just daily routine. Now suddenly I have to revisit those exact same quandaries in a completely different context for the very first time. And so I think that's a wonderful quote and a wonderful way of looking at the usefulness of storytelling.
Perhaps you don't even need to love them. You just need to protect them, like put them on an escort mission. You have to save this princess who's the only hope for peace in the land, and she's kind of a little bit of a brat.
Oh, man.
So Star Wars.
It's not so much that she's like, just, oh, gosh, it would be easier. Like, really, do we need peace? But it's like, she needs you to get this, and she needs you to get that, and she's not very helpful, and she's not helpful at all. She
really cries only and hearing runs Star Wars, I promise you.
What?
I'm really only hearing the plot of Star Wars.
Hey, Leia actually turned out to be pretty useful in the end, alright?
Not only that,
but she is now officially the best Disney princess ever.
When you rescue her, she's already got a honey-do list.
Yeah. It's a good shot, though.
I think in that particular case, we go back to 1 Corinthians 13:1. If I speak in the tongues of men and angels, but have not love, or a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal.
Ain't that the truth.
All right, I think that probably wraps us up for the evening. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and do this with us, especially since we had a bunch of technical difficulties that the listeners will mercifully be spared, that took us, what, I don't know, about an hour and a half to get resolved before we could start recording. So thanks for both your coming on and your patience.
In regard to the former, thank you very much for having me. It's been an honor to be on here with you guys. In regard to the latter, fret not, because there are a whole lot of similar problems here. The Boot still struggles with it. We also spared the listeners from, so... As I said to you guys in chat earlier, this is not my first time to the rodeo. So,
I certainly appreciate your patience. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
And for those of you who have come to Saving the Game through routes other than Fear the Boot, we do encourage you to go listen to Fear the Boot. They're really good, and their forums are fantastic. We're actually getting more and more people who are coming to us from other ways than Fear the Boot.
Community of shows.
I think we're up to a whole nine or something like that. I don't know. Probably a quarter of our traffic is from RPG podcasts.
My mom finally started listening.
Yeah, well, all right, fine. All right, on that note, folks, have a good evening. Dan, thank you very much for being on the show. Folks, good night.
Bye.
Good night, everybody.
This has been a production of Saving the Game, copyright 2012. This podcast may be redistributed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative license, provided that credit is given to savingthegamepodcast.org. Our music is by Ryan Humphrey. For past episodes, podcast news from our hosts, or to connect with us, visit our website at savingthegamepodcast.org. God bless, and happy gaming.